You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show. Conversations with Brian Callen. Brian Callen and Big Ideas. My father said that maybe you should have a show called I Have Nothing to Do Right Now, So This Is Better Than Nothing or something. And I don't appreciate that suggestion from you, Big Mike. I never do a show anymore where I don't have at least three, four, or five people come up and say, you got to get more Big Mike. We need Big Mike on the podcast. So here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Big Mike Callen, back by popular demand, here to talk about all things life. We'll get some perspective from the 73-year-old. You read a book recently.
Was the 73-year-old part really a part of the show?
Sorry. And
can you edit these things?
I apologize. You look better than, you look much younger than that. Well, let's hold the mic to our face then, all right? Thanks. You look great. You got a little bit of a belly.
I'm working on that.
Well, you're not though. See, what's amazing is that you are, and I don't, you know, I know this is a podcast, but you're a liar. I mean, let's be honest. You're a man of good character, but at the end of the day, you're also a liar. You have your vices, and that's probably, I think you sneak pie and cookies and things when I'm not looking. And I find it disappointing.
That's pure conjecture, which is not the way our criminal justice system has been structured
by evidence,
the founding
sir.
Fathers. The evidence, but the I was had a bigger belly 6 months ago.
I don't know if that's true. Again,
well, that's a good
I
way
feel
of
like
putting
you're
it.
Lying.
You don't know, so you hold out the possibility okay. that truth has deluded you.
That's true. You are wearing running shoes. You read a book recently you told me about. It was by a guy, I think, who was a journalist for 40 years. Do you remember what it was called? It's sort of what I learned after all this time, something like that.
Fareed Zakaria?
No. It was a guy, it was basically the gist of the book was, here's what I learned after 40 years of being in on the world stage or interviewing and reporting on the news, basically.
You know, I read so many books that I have to look back at the list. I've read recently, I recommend to your audience, The Post-American World by Fareed Zakaria. And Fareed Zakaria is a highly intelligent, but more than that, there's intelligence of all different kinds, but there's also insightfulness, and he has that. And what is lacking mainly in the current, and I think this has always been true, the current dialogue that one participates in as a listener or actual participant on television, even in journalism, but less in print journalism, by the way. More in television is a lack of perspective. That word should be spelled for everybody. And here are a couple of examples that Fareed Zakaria of perspective has brought into the dialogue, which are very important. I would put this under the headline, things have never been better, but you can be forgiven for not appreciating that reality. Two examples. One, there is less violence and death in the world today than there ever has been. And these kinds of statistics are tracked by organizations, something I didn't know. The two cases he cites, and we'll get to the reason in a second, are the killing fields in Cambodia in the 1970s, which I'm old enough to remember distinctly. There were about 1.75 million people slaughtered systematically. But if you were doing, for example, what I was doing at that point, you might have been aware of that, but you didn't dwell on it. The other one is the Iran-Iraq War. There were two of them. That was in the 1980s, where 1 million combatants were killed. 1 million. Think about that. Those two countries would just throw waves of people at each other and they'd all be cut down in both directions. And then Saddam at the time and the Shah hugged and made up at a meeting of the Middle East countries. And so we put that aside. Now, why today, when we have a car bomb in Iraq or Afghanistan or God knows other places, you're not going to escape that if you get your news from television, because what a lot of people don't realize, and I've been close enough to television to get an appreciation of this, is they have 24 hours to fill, and that is a very, very tough job for producers to fill. Violence sells well in their business. And so they will highlight, and you will see where you never would have when there were only four networks. You will see the car bomb, the aftermath of it, the blown up car. So how could you not have the impression that there's so much violence and things are so terrible? It's almost impossible not to come away from your daily life and the exposure you have to various communication channels with that impression. The other reporting we get all the time is poverty and inequality. There is poverty. No one can cite a time in history there wasn't a lot of that. There is inequality. By the way, if you take the financial sector in the United States out of the equation, and it's a fairly small sector in terms of number of people, the numbers look quite a bit different. But there's equality. There's inequality. Whenever there is a lack of economic growth in historic annals, there's been an increase in inequality. And that's a problem. We've got to try to deal with it. Usually, however, when attacking that issue, the problem gets worse because people attack those who are well off. And that's not a useful or constructive solution to inequality. But going back to my point on Zachariah, the poverty reporting and the poverty discussion is less trenchant than it used to be, because the emphasis is that we have impoverished people. However, there isn't hunger because of food stamps and the earned income tax credit and the aid to families with dependent children. The level of poverty when compared to the richest is something that can make a good story, but it is nothing like it was, I remember, when I was a kid before we had the Great Society programs, where there were really hungry people. I mean, really, really bad cases in this country. And, you know, remember the starving millions in India, which now don't exist anymore.
Yeah, large tracts of the world were starving, actually starving. Children died not only of a lack of food, malnutrition, but also diseases like smallpox, etc., that are now eradicated. So there's no question things are getting better. That doesn't mean things aren't always going to be, there's not always going to be challenges and things. I heard something interesting about the idea, Steven Pinker's book about, I think we have a problem with, you know, the young people or people who are on their way to gaining perspective will tend to come upon a new idea and decide that everything else is excluded and this is the new idea and this is the truth, instead of realizing that that new idea should be incorporated and can be connected to these other ideas. A little bit like, don't look at the world as just atoms and quarks. It's one reality, but that's not going to help you explain how World War I started or why your relationship is falling apart. So you've got to be inclusive in your knowledge base.
I listen to your podcasts, and they're interesting. By the way, genuinely, let's put the humor that always courses between us ever since you were a little kid. Let's put it aside for only a second. Mm-hmm. I want to get right
only
back to it.
Only 1 second, yep.
I'm humbled to be a guest, because as your podcast has matured, the guests you're getting, like David Robinson and Snyder, Ropeblood Lands, and so forth, is a league of scholarship and intellectual content that I wouldn't even imagine reaching. So I'm your common everyman walking down the street who's had a good career and all that kind of stuff, but I haven't written those books.
Well, you're pretty good at, I think one of the reasons you're so popular is you're very clear and concise and good at explaining, you know, what you're trying to say. You know, it's not, I don't see that a lot.
Let me try to explain one thing I'm trying to say. because you talk to people who have done some investigative work and then wrote a book about Big Pharma, about the banking crisis, and those type of things. I am sure that you will have somebody who has written a book about the homeless, for example. If you and I were to sit here and list the number of problems society encounters every day, we wouldn't have anything else to talk about. We couldn't talk about each of the problems. We could list them forever. Environmental, acid rain, whatever. Now, here is the point I'd like to make about all of that. There is a great tension in the society we call America and some of the European societies. And the tension is between recognition on the one hand, these problems exist. Let's just take poverty as a quick example. These problems exist. There are people who have a tendency to become totally devoted and fanatical about problems like this, and that's always by itself a problem because you lose, again, perspective. So that's one thing. Then the other side of that which creates this tension is we have to modify our system of government, which is diffused, based on constitution, and has a certain role outlined for the government. And your solution to the problem you have discovered and analyzed is usually to change the Constitution, change the role of government, and increase and impose upon people a whole bunch of restrictions and freedom limitations that will solve my problem I'm so fanatical about. I think the best example in this respect is global warming. You can talk about global warming. And I've never had a problem with the data, the analysis. There's exaggeration here on both sides. A recent report released by the White House is a pure and total political document. We haven't had any warming for 12, 13 years. There's reasons the warmest can give for that, and scientists, and there are thoughtful reasons. But the facts are, you cannot say, as this report said, that even now as we speak, we have had, we have suffered all the effects when we've had one of the coldest winters we've had in years. You know, people just aren't going to believe that. But that is not my main point. My main point is, what are you going to do about global warming? What you're going to do, as you do in almost all of these cases, is coerce free people to do things they really don't want to do. And the elitists and the leadership, and I'm using the word fanatics here, like the Al Gores, who think this is the worst thing that's ever happened, but then he never experienced World War II, right? this is the worst thing that ever happened. And therefore, we have to pass some laws that our founding fathers would never have considered imaginable coming from the oppression of Europe when they founded the country. But here, this is an exception. We really have to force people to live the way we think they have to live. It's very tough.
I don't know how fair you're being there. I mean, I do think that the reality of living in a huge society with all these people is that there are some laws that make the air cleaner. Secondhand smoke. I don't want people smoking when I'm doing stand-up. That's a good law. It actually affects my health. When I had to do stand-up and everybody was smoking, doing the road would have killed me. Literally probably given me cancer. I like the idea that when I'm on a plane, people aren't allowed to smoke. I like the idea that, for example, the government came along and said, you can't have incinerators in your backyard because it's causing a major pollution problem. So there are common sense laws that, I mean, for example, Bobby Kennedy Jr., say what you will, he's an environmental lawyer, he's very, very much on the left, but Bobby said something really interesting at a benefit I did. He said, I grew up where I cannot fish in the Hudson or the Potomac. I wasn't able to take fish out of those rivers because they were too polluted. I couldn't throw a hook in and catch a fish and bring it home to my family. I couldn't really swim in it. And the problem with that is that should be a public body of water for people to enjoy. And when industry comes in, and they need that water to do certain things, whether it's transport, fuel, or whatever it might be, and they pollute it, they should be responsible for cleaning it up. there are very intelligent arguments that support those kinds of things. So sometimes there is no choice. Sometimes you've got two answers. One is legislation. The other, of course, is information. When scientists come along and say, look, these companies are polluting this waterway, then what happens is you have to say to people, hey, guys, you sure you want to buy these products from this company? This company is not responsible. So when you buy something, it's also a vote. When you buy something, you know, when you reach into your pocket, a lot of times you can have a great effect on being a conscientious purchaser of goods. So you hit it two ways. My guess is you're more inclined to get the information out there and let people make their choice of whether or not they want to buy from that company or not.
I'm not even taking an ideological position here, but I do like the no smoking model that we've experienced and the drunk driving model we've experienced in this country.
Yeah.
See, the United States is unique in several ways. By the way, much less unique than it used to be if you look hard at the data. And again, Fareed Zakaria in his book does that. I'm going to mention another book so you remind me, Bertrand Russell, which is an old book written during the war, The History of Western Philosophy, and I'm about two-thirds through that. Everybody should read it three times, but nobody would. But let's get back to Fareed Zakaria.
Many people, by the way, would suggest that book, A History of Western Philosophy, is the greatest book on philosophy ever written.
Well, it's not really written on philosophy. Bertrand Russell is not giving you a philosophy of his own. All he is doing is taking you from Aristotle all the way up through right now. We're talking about Descartes. And he's just giving you a summary of who they were and what they said.
Right.
And the progress that was made. By the way, he says the 17th century was one of the most illuminating.
Which I want to get to after you're done with your point.
Oh, yeah, okay. Right. Now, The Zakaria point, which is, I think, so much worthwhile reading, he talks about how this country has changed, and not by any means all for the better, how it has declined relative to the rest of the world, and that's why he calls it the post-American world. And it's not that the United States is getting worse, it's that so many other countries are getting better. We all talk every day in the newspapers about the shift to Asia. Asia has truly risen and become very, very powerful, whereas Europe is at a cycle in its history where people are consuming and trying to grab a piece of the pie, and there isn't much production. Italy is a classic case. Portugal, Spain, policies through many years, and they're really paying a price. France, even more so, under Hollande, but that'll all work itself out. My point is somewhat different. It may sound subtle. If you default to the government-imposed option on every problem you identify, I don't like where that ends up over time.
Yeah, me neither.
But it's very tough to decide where to call a halt, and that's why I think global warming is such an interesting point of discussion. Because drunk driving, no problem. Smoking, information did it.
Yeah.
And I loved the way that worked.
Yep.
And I was a banker to the tobacco companies, and they saw what was going to happen, and they ran off and tried to buy other kinds of businesses. Coca-Cola now is running scared because sugar has been and is in the process of being revealed is really bad for you, the cause of our pandemic of obesity.
They're having a real problem, aren't
they? Stop looking at my stomach when I say those things, right?
I heard there was a crisis at Coca-Cola of conscience, some of the younger people kind of going, we're making a product that's just poisonous to children.
Well, their current line, not without some benefit, is don't overuse the product. We're talking here about, down in Texas, they have a 55-ounce cup you can take into the theater with you of real Coke.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
And that if you drink Coke every day, you're going to be something like 20 to 25 pounds heavier. And I'd recommend, by the way, I read a lot and I try to gather information. So my role in your podcast is to share with people Dr. Robert Lustig,
Yeah, I've talked about this before.
University of California.
I think he's got
an hour and a half.
And endocrinologist and a pediatric doctor.
Yeah, yeah, he's a pediatric. He looks after children who are obese. But, you know, it's one of these
seminal... It's an hour and a half lecture on YouTube. It's Robert Lustig and Dr. Robert Lustig, and it's, what's it called?
Sugar is Poison.
Sugar is Poison.
The Poison of Sugar, something. Yeah. Poison and Sugar in the title.
I recommend that it's to everybody.
It's going
to
take an effort because it's an hour and a half. For those of you who are parents out there, it seems to me that this is replaced Dr. Spock as the one thing you've got to really...
Well, he does such a good job of proving it scientifically. Gary Taub has done a lot of work on this. Barry Sears. I mean, I've been reading this stuff for years now about sort of how detrimental sugar and simple carbs are for the most part to your body.
You know, I
consume them every day or in large.
I use the idea of fanatics in a pejorative way. But we're all fanatics when it comes to certain things. I'm fanatic about my family.
Well, we all have to be careful about our religious sort of bents. You know, human beings seem to be religious. If they're atheists, they're sometimes very religious about that. If they're vegans, vegans are generally very religious. Paleo, people who do the paleo diet, they eat the way, you know, we did as cavemen, they're religious. I mean, they'll bread, keep that bread away from me. Well, Europe was built on bread. You know, and it goes back to saying, you know, I try to live my life. There are ways to live your life where you can be healthy and you can be a little extreme at times if you want, but moderation is really what it's about. Balance is very important. When was the last time?
Let me finish what I was about to say. And I just find when I was running a large financial firm as the chairman and the CEO, we were hiring some people and a bunch of folks said to me, you got to see this guy. And I said, look, I'm not going to make every hiring decision. You decide. You know, but we just want your opinion. We want you to spend a half an hour with him. So I did what I was told. And he looked fine to me. He looked smart, good experience, but everything we were looking for. And I was going to call the people that were in charge of hiring this fellow and say, yes, I approve. And I had to leave the building down on Wall Street. And so I took the elevator down and I'm walking out. Here is this guy standing outside smoking. He did not get the job. And I reflected on that later, and I said, well, number one, he's stupid to smoke. Not that I had thank you for not smoking signs on my desk or anything, but anybody who can gather the information that is readily available, especially with his education, Harvard Business School, all that, and cannot control themselves...
Yeah, I don't look at it that way. I mean, I appreciate that you have your...
Well, this podcast is over, I'll tell you.
Yeah. No, I understand. I think that's a little harsh because I think everyone has their
I said
vices.
I'm a fanatic on something.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Okay, that's a good point. You tend to eat a lot of sugar in pie.
Oh!
Well, I'm saying it might be the exact same thing.
This podcast is really
over. This is a great way to piggyback into and segue into something I want to talk about because you're mentioning Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy and self-control. You know, he didn't get the job because you felt that he didn't have the self-control to not smoke, even though he probably knew it was very bad for you and the information was out there. You could say the same thing about somebody who eats a lot of sugar, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, as we learn more about the human...
I just want to say to your audience, never treat your parents the way you're hearing
well,
me treat.
I understand. But as we learn more about how the human brain works and how the human body works and genetics... It seems to me that there are those of us who are riding a small pony and we're able to steer that pony, and there are those of us riding an elephant and we have no control over it. That's something that I think genetics and the new science of, you know, the brain and stuff is showing. The fact that some people are wired in a way where they have no control over how they behave. In fact... There's a lot of evidence to suggest that maybe, you know, we behave a certain way, and then the other side of our brain tells a story about that to justify it. What does that say about free will and things?
If you're asking me,
in other words,
what it says about free will is it's a very, very broad subject. I was in the Marine Corps, which you may remember, you weren't around, and the discipline and environment it created was one where if I had been told to charge up a hill where a machine gun was going to cut me to threads, I wouldn't have hesitated. I would have charged up the hill. And what kind of free will is that? It was overwhelmed. You know, so much of this is cost benefit. It was overwhelmed by the inability to imagine disobeying an order in an organization devoted to the causes that it was and to the machine that it was designed to be. And I volunteered to be a part of that machine. And I knew it could result in death. But the worst in death in that ideology, in that environment, was cowardice.
Yeah.
I would have been shot anyway.
Yeah.
Not yeah. after a trial. I would have been shot in the midst of the battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's so situational to me.
It's very situational. But I wonder at times if they show, which they are showing, that serial killers, for example, have different brains. They may have brain damage. Some criminals, antisocial behavior, children, have either different brains, damaged brains,
But it's not about the damaged brain. It's about the society they're living in. If they have a damaged brain, which causes them to murder your daughter who was just here, and they get some kind of pleasure out of that, get rid of them, whether you incarcerate or you kill.
Well, that's right. What I'm saying is...
And by the way, you're talking here about hard cases making bad laws.
Well, no, I'm just saying it brings into question sort of what is punitive then? Punitive measures versus, just putting somebody in a hospital and things. It just raises interesting questions where we say, well, that person's evil. As you can put a biology on it, when you can put a biological mathematical number, his polychains, his whatever it is, he's got certain, you can look at certain parts of his brain and they're obviously not as developed. Now you can put a number on that. Now what does it say about evil, good and evil, the idea of philosophy? Doesn't it change things? Isn't this a new idea?
Well, you can support capital punishment without vengeance being any part of it. Right?
Stella, we are podcasting. We are podcasting. We'll be with you in a little bit, okay? And we're going to be finished, but you cannot do this right now. All right? Amanda! We'll be with you in a half hour, sweetie. Okay? Do not do that again.
All right, anyway, back to this.
You can support capital punishment, by the way, without being vindictive.
That's right.
Without wanting to see somebody in pain. And the argument there, and I think I've said this before in the podcast, but very briefly, is if you postulate that we don't know whether capital punishment is a deterrent or not. Now, I lived in Saudi Arabia, and so did you. And I watch people being beheaded. They don't have a lot of crime in Saudi Arabia. Now, if you want to try to attribute and correlate the lack of crime to the way they punish people who commit sexual crimes, drug crimes, certainly murder, you could preach that case. On the other hand, they're very strictly Islamic society, so maybe that's got a lot to do with it. But let me finish the point. And this was a William Buckley argument, which, because there's so much emotion and passion surrounding all this, if you postulate that we don't know whether capital punishment is a deterrent, you must execute murderers. And the reason for that is if it is a deterrent, and until we can satisfactorily ascertain that, which we have not done, if it is a deterrent, then by executing a murderer, you are saving innocent lives who would otherwise have been murdered by some guy out there who just doesn't want to take the risk of execution.
Yeah.
And if it is not a deterrent, then you are sacrificing the life of a convicted murderer, but one man.
Yeah.
Many of these guys are multiple. So the equation here is very clear. You've got to be...
Well, there's the saying that punishment doesn't change behavior. It just suppresses behavior. But you do need a threat of punishment out there for certain people, because you're right, there are sickos out there and bad people who will not do that crime because they don't want to spend the rest of their life in jail or in an electric chair.
Well, I would just in passing comment that I spend time at a shooting range in Utah. It's a big gun state. And you can get an AK-47, a 30 caliber machine gun. My grandchildren get a big kick out of firing that stuff. Highly controlled conditions, and I take them there because I want them to learn the safe use of firearms. There are millions of them out there, so I don't want them to be unaware.
Yeah.
And I also would like to purge them of any fascination with these weapons. While we're there on this range, invariably there are some characters firing these weapons, and you can just see they're imagining as they fire at these targets.
Yeah.
They're shooting bad guys, or they're shooting people who were mean to them or humiliated them at work.
Yeah.
And I want a reason beyond just the normal ones that they're not going to give in to these impulses. God knows there are enough people that do give in to them, and we read about them. You know, and so that's a tough problem to me. It's a tough problem. There are societies like Britain, China, where nobody has a gun.
Nobody.
You wouldn't have anything like this because nobody can get a
gun. What do you think of gun control?
Well, first of all, it's like immigration. This country, unlike many, has laws like jaywalking in New York, which have never been enforced, and therefore they're no longer laws.
Yeah.
They can be used in a discriminatory fashion to say, okay, buddy, I'm going to pull you over because you spit on the sidewalk, also against the law. You jaywalked in Manhattan. Who ever heard of such a thing? But your real objective is you don't like the way they talk, or you don't for some other reason. You're never going to get rid of guns now in this country because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
I have one, you have one, and I'm not a violent person. I like target shooting, and you're never going to get rid of them. You're never going to get rid of 12 million immigrants. We don't care about immigration. In fact, we support what is now called illegal immigration because it's a country of immigrants. Everybody in this country was an immigrant at one time
or
another. So why should we deny other people that come across that border just because our politics has been unable to impose a sensible immigration policy? I am not against immigrants. I don't care if they're illegal immigrants. And I suggest that a very large portion of this country doesn't either. Can't go to a state in the union where you don't find a lot of illegals, but they're doing useful work.
That's right.
And I like useful work.
Yep, that's true. So, what is your policy on them? Is there sensible immigration policy?
Well, you would legalize everybody here. I've thought a lot about this. I mean, you would legalize everybody here because the idea of deportation is simply not practicable.
It's also heartbreaking.
Of course.
I mean, there are people who have been living here 20 years.
Why are their families and children and all that less valuable than us? So you have parents who did sneak across the border, had children here. Because we use the de jure and the sous, we have a policy of those children are citizens. We're going to send the parents back to Mexico? No.
No.
Nobody supports that.
I don't want to.
We're
going to
load freight cars with people or something? Is that redolent of some period in the past? It's not going to happen. They have been integrated into this society. And I don't care what some of these America First or whatever you might call them. On that, I suppose I'm way over on the left. No. You're not going to do that. So an immigration policy, first of all, is to deal with the 12 million or so we have here and legalize them under some program. We can debate back and forth, take 10 podcasts to get through all of that. But the attitude towards immigrants has to be totally positive. And then you have, the one thing I do tomorrow is if you have a PhD in any scientific subject, you automatically have a visa in your passport. You live here. We need those people working.
We need those people.
MIT is graduating 50% of non-citizens.
And we send them back, don't we, after they...
Because of the nature of the visa they're here under.
We haven't amended that.
Now, by the way, both sides of this debate agree on that point.
And we haven't... Why has that not been amended?
Well, because it's part of a much larger bill. Boehner in the Congress is saying, let's take this a piece at a time, for example, this part.
Yeah.
And the Democrats have a bias here themselves. I saw a cartoon not long ago where people are coming, sneaking across the border, coming over the fence, and walking right into a shed on the U.S. side of the border that says Democratic registration, register here. Almost everybody coming across is going to be a Democrat. So they have...
Why?
You look at the last election, 73% of the Hispanic vote went Obama.
that's
95% of the African American.
The Republicans are very much about. I mean, they better figure out a way to harness that Latin vote, or they're going to be in some trouble. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is there's a growing population of powerful, there's a powerful Latin voting base.
And, yeah, on
and
the other
very
hand,
conservative.
The other side of that, just by the way, is that the Hispanic vote is conservative, it's Catholic.
It's very conservative, yeah.
And there are many things that are going to clash with the Democratic principles and party. There's an old saying, which I think is very true. If you want to know which way the politics in this country, especially the big cities, are going, look at the school boards, the composition of the school boards.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because the school boards determine educational policy, determine curriculum, and eventually, you know, when the Hispanics got into the country, they weren't playing much. We had African Americans dominating school boards. Just look across the country, New York, the big cities in particular, Chicago and places. The Hispanics have supplanted the African Americans, and they're a conservative group. They don't want birth control taught in schools. They don't want sex education. And just watch how this evolves. I mean, they come from a different tradition entirely.
A Catholic tradition. Kind of like the Irish in that sense, like conservative that way.
Yeah, the Irish had the same kind of
I have a problem with that. My problem is that I can't believe that intelligent design is something that's actually talked about or taught in school. I think it's outrageous. It is religious. It is creationism. And first of all, you're teaching religion in school. That's intelligent design is religion. Second of all, there's zero scientific evidence for it.
But I wouldn't worry about it.
And evolution is not it's about as much a theory as is gravity.
But, I mean, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because it's like the President Obama, who I wouldn't vote for. I did once. I wouldn't do it again. But he was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner the other night, and I'm reminded of one of his one-line funnies. And he was talking about this guy, Bundy, down in Texas, who's gotten a lot of national press and should have been ignored. But Obama said the following.
Well, Bundy was the one who said...
I'm going to take off on that with Obama's comment.
Oh.
Obama said, let me tell you the start of a sentence where you don't have to listen to anything that comes after the beginning. What I know about the Negro, and then he got... washed away with huge laughter from this very large audience.
Yeah.
And that was reference to
the Bundy. If you start a sentence by, what I know about the Negro, you don't really have to listen to anything
else. You don't have to listen to anything else, right? I mean, in today's world, this guy, and the same thing with some of these issues like creationism.
Yeah.
Creationism is lost. There is a rear guard on some school boards in Kansas and Texas that think it should be taught as an alternative. And just let me tell you where this was, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
25 years ago, the debate was we should at least mention evolution.
Amazing.
And where it is now, because they lost,
yeah,
we should mention creationism. And the idea, it's like a football team that loses 147-0. At the end of the game, they still get to shake hands, go down the line and shake hands with the opposing team.
Yeah,
that's all. Shake their hand. That's all you have to.
Well, I don't.
Let's talk about, because you don't have a lot of time on the podcast left yet.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Bertrand Russell and the history of Western philosophy. I think you have some serious.
That's a book you would recommend to everybody.
Yeah, but it's tough. It's tough.
Why? Why would you recommend?
It's tough. It's long. It's long. And it's one of these books, like all philosophy, you have to read 2 and 3 times. But right. let me give you one of the main messages coming out of this book. And again, it goes back to my message on perspective. It starts with Aristotle, comes right up through St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas. I've gotten as far as Descartes. But he's just finished The Rise of Science with Isaac Newton, Galileo, Copernicus, and so forth. Okay. It's the kind of book that you're going to read after 3 months. You're going to put it down and say, I'm not sure what I got out of that. But you got to sit back after every chapter and say, now, is there anything I can remember that means something? Here is what it says. It says that in the first 1800 years of recorded history, I'm going back to the time of Aristotle in 300 BC, up to the 17th century AD, the world you lived in as a human being was one where there was two things, doctrine and heresy, nothing in between. And if you were accused of being a heretic, you and your family would be killed and your bones burned.
A heretic is someone, by the way, guys, who just denounces
or doesn't accept
God and the Bible.
Doesn't accept the doctrinal tenets of
the church,
the power in place. Usually the popes.
Or the
king,
or whatever.
There was this constant struggle between the pope and the emperor.
Yeah.
That's the world you lived in. God forbid you say, are you sure that this business of the Trinity, that's all you would have to say. And you're on trial for your life and your family's, and you're probably going to lose it, lose that life, right? That's the way it was. Then we had the rise of science. Galileo paid a huge price, and we won't go into all that because people either know or
Copernicus
can easily find it. Copernicus, the same thing. They came up with the truth of how the universe is structured. And then we have this old expression, everything was lost in the dark of the night. God said, let there be Newton. And then there was light.
And then there was light.
Isaac Newton, the greatest scientist history has ever produced. And we're talking the middle of the 17th century, right? And the man lived to be in his early 80s. I mean, what Bertrand Russell does is give you a little background on each one of these scientists, which itself is fascinating. They were all, in some respects, weirdos. But they brought us science. Now, what do we have today? And I'd like to make this statement because I think it's important. We have 90%, maybe higher, talking about the United States, 95% of the people have no notion of what the scientific method is about, and 5% use the scientific method. Two sentences to support that. What most of us think of as science is called confirmation bias. We form a conclusion first. The conclusion is global warming. I hate to keep using that because I don't want to sound like a fanatic, but global warming is going to kill us all. You've heard somebody make a speech and they really inspired you. So global warming is going to kill us all. And the proof is, and you look around and you say, look at that storm on the East Coast, Sandy, caused by global warming. We got to do something. That's called confirmation bias. We all use it. Even scientists use it.
Yep.
I formed the conclusion I'm going to look around in this mosaic of a universe, and I got to pick out something that supports my position.
That's right. We form a belief system around, you know, we get emotionally attached to our belief system.
Much, much more difficult is the scientific method. I don't have a conclusion. Yeah, I wish certain things were true because I'm human, but I don't have a conclusion. So I'm going to go out and collect all the data I can. I'm going to put a number of tests to it. You know, the way they do in a laboratory.
Yeah.
And God, look at this. It appears, but I can't be certain. Can never be certain. It appears that if you inject poison into a mouse, it dies. Looks like that happens every time. And you deduce and you write your report, and it's boring as hell. It's boring as hell, but that's where all of our real progress comes from. That's why we don't have very many airplane accidents anymore or car accidents. That's why we have all the safety features. That's why it's a much better life. That's why we have flat screen TVs, the whole damn thing all the way down the road. And if you look at a country, and there's a great article in the Wall Street Journal today about Russia. Russia is a disaster. Forget the Ukraine and all the headlines. Their country, with their lifespans, their health levels, the direction of all this, God forbid where this is all going. Their lifespan, the expected life of a 15-year-old is 51.
Wow.
Well, I mean, you know, come on. It's going to be tuberculosis. Accidental death in Russia is three times higher. It's higher than it is in Haiti. I recommend people grab the article. And you know, whatever you think of the Wall Street Journal, this is a very good piece of work. What it's trying to say is, again, perspective. Ukraine, I understand. But on the other hand, how would you like to be in that situation, in the society that they've got, and it's all come out of 70 years of communism. You know, this didn't end the day in 1989.
Yeah. Putin's a product of the Russian mindset, isn't he? I mean, he's not.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he'd
be another Putin if Putin went. I mean, you know.
Look at their whole history. That's two other books I'd recommend: Catherine the Great and Peter the Great by Robert Massey. I mean, again, Undertakings. They're on Audible, and they're very useful background to have underneath your feet when you're thinking about gee whiz, Crimea, and Ukraine and all that. But that's going out into the outer space here for a second. But that society is in serious trouble. Most of its social indices are down with Mali, Haiti. But they've got nuclear weapons, so we treat them very differently, right? For me, I doubt the nuclear weapons would work, but I'm not going to take that chance either.
What is at the crux of Russia's biggest problem? The fact that there are no, it's what William Bernstein said, I guess, there's no real property rights. I mean, it's might makes right.
There is no rule of law.
There's no rule of law.
If some guy, and it's not just Putin, you know, Putin doesn't, he didn't know.
It's the guy with the biggest guns, the biggest muscles.
Yeah, whatever member of the quote-unquote party, despite it having been declared illegal. By the way, what happened when Boris Yeltsin declared the Communist Party illegal is everybody just went to work the same place and became a gangster. And again, that would have been quite predictable. And the gangsters, and I used to go there all the time. I probably spent as much time in Russia as most people. And I saw somebody kidnapped. I mean, I'll never forget it. And it was right behind a hotel.
What happened?
Oh, there was a guy that they grabbed. I saw him grab him. And they pushed him into a car, and he was trying to resist. And they were beating him, and I'm sure they took him out and shot him. And it's the way the society worked, because it is the way the society had worked for 70 years. It's the way.
Were you able to even tell anybody?
I wouldn't have meant a thing. I was with a Russian, and the Russian, I said, you got to call the police. And they said, for what? But that's all part of the society and the way it worked. It's been working that way forever. You know, it's got nothing to do with what your contribution in terms of increasing wealth or any of that. It had nothing to do with anything. They have a surfeit of pianists. They have an incredible surplus of harpists. So every restaurant you go into, there's somebody playing the piano and playing it well, and somebody playing the harp and playing it well, because the Communist Party allocated this number of people to go to that school, learn music. And that was the only way they had to get anywhere, to get up in the world. And, you know, it was all a question of whether you could get give a pack of cigarettes, Western cigarettes, to the landlord.
With somebody as intelligent as Putin, wouldn't it make, and don't you think he's aware of what the problem is, the philosophical, do you think that he has read Aristotle? Do you think he understands these things? He's got to be a very smart guy. I'm always amazed that people who have such exposure to the world don't know that their ideas and their philosophies and even the way they live is a bankrupt policy.
Well, you know, the thing I've been most impressed with, and I don't know Putin, I can't comment intelligently, but you're always amazed looking back at Gorbachev, who much more than Putin came out of a system where every criteria for success was the one of, you know, basically stepping over dead bodies that you caused to be dead because they were in your way. And then he gets to where he did and suddenly turns around. I did have a conversation with Gorbachev's translator, of all people, and I met the translator at a Council on Foreign Relations session that Putin was at. And then later I went to Russia, and I was in a building where KPMG that I was consulting with was there, and we were walking down one of the halls, and this translator came by, and I stopped him and said hello. And he was a guy who could listen to Putin as he was speaking Russian and simultaneously translate into English. And I stopped him, and I said, you wouldn't remember me, but I shook your hand. And he said, oh, yeah, that was a great trip. It's like you're speaking to somebody from the Bronx. His English was so good. And I said, is your boss, are you still working for Mr. Gorbachev? Yes, when he goes abroad, when he needs a translation. Yes, I enjoy the work and so forth. And I said, it must have been fascinating to be at the summit meetings with Reagan and all. And he said, yes, very, very hard work, exhausting, and it was. And I said, probably a question you've been asked before. Did Gorbachev always have the attitude that enabled him to implement perestroika and glasnost and all of this? And he said, no, he did not. When he was Minister of Agriculture, he was as good a communist and as blind as anybody could be. When he became General Secretary and then later President of the Soviet Union, he started looking around him, and your point on Putin, and he said, you know, I have been hoodwinked. It's not the language. I have been fooling myself.
I'm sure Putin knows that, unless he's just a sociopath
now,
and doesn't care.
Putin comes out of a dissolution of the Soviet Empire.
Yeah.
And he is a man who did everything he could, including was paid to break laws, because he was head of the KGB. That's what they did. To get where he wanted. God knows how many murders are on his hands, because the head of the KGB was, they murdered people regularly. There wasn't anything like a trial. And, you know, so he's got to have enormous amounts of blood in his hands. Now, he's trying to be respectable and Mr. Good Guy. But if you look at his background and what must be underneath his feet, there's got to be a tremendous amount of impaired vision here.
Yeah.
He's also
had to live in a world where what he does works. I mean, the reality of Putin's look, when you're Russian at the top of the food chain, talking Aristotle and understanding, you know, Plato isn't going to help you really.
But the whole society is a power structure.
That's what I mean. So really, you're asking him to believe in or even talk about or investigate something that has no relevance to his particular. You know,
and the hard truth is he got to the top by killing opponents.
That's probably true.
And in the United States, you become president. You didn't kill anybody.
Do you think that our CIA is in danger of becoming too powerful?
No. I think the CIA is given 25 times more credit than it deserves. I think the CIA has done some tremendous things. I think they have done some really dumb things. But when you use the word CIA, and as you know, it's been in a book, I wasn't a permanent part, but I was a co-opted asset for a while, so I had something to do with this in various parts of the world. The main part of the CIA is the analytical side.
Yeah.
The operations side that you're referring to, and everybody does when they say CIA, is the cloak and dagger stuff. And that has never been as important. They have... they've had some famous victories, let's face it, during the Cold War. The Barents Sea, Kaper, and just for people that may not know that, if you want to read a good book on the CIA, Blind Man's Bluff, and what that is about is that the Soviets were pretty sloppy about things. And we had submarines take CIA people down to the bottom of the Barents Sea, put a listening device on a cable that carried communication traffic across the ocean. They actually showed us where these cables were with a sign on the shore scene. Be careful of digging here, cable underneath, you know, kind of thing that not even we would do. One of the greatest coups the CIA ever pulled off. And because it's been so top secret until recently, they couldn't get any credit for it, but they're used to that. One of the great coups they pulled off, beside Osama bin Laden, which, by the way, I think was a great job, was when the Russians were laying an antenna cable from the middle of Moscow, basically KGB headquarters, about 6 miles out to the very top of a hill, where they built a very powerful transmitter that was going to transmit all of their assets around the world, a high-frequency transmitter. And because of the corruption within the society, the CIA was managed to pay off some of the construction workers and get blueprints. And then they would crawl on their bellies, believe it or not, and put a listening device on this cable and would intercept all the traffic going from KGB headquarters out to its assets. So for about, this is from the mid-70s until mid-80s, what has not yet been revealed in a broad way is that for, and it's all in Blyman's Bluff, so I'm not telling secrets, for a long time is we were intercepting all the cable traffic between KGB headquarters and their people
That's
out
amazing.
There. And that was a CIA operation, so, you know. And well, they did the Osama thing.
Yeah, I mean, they did an amazing job. As you're talking, you know, so much of the reason the CIA has been so good is because we are a society that is ruled by law, and a free society. So it allows for ingenuity and stuff. When was the last time at 73, and you've read a lot and you know a lot, when was the last time, because I read a lot of books for this podcast, and one of the things I noticed is that there are a lot of great ideas out there, but there aren't an infinite number of great ideas. When was the last time you were shocked by a new idea? Or when was the last time your paradigm was shifted? When was the last time a new idea really hit you? Because you've been exposed to all of them.
I was going to talk about this, but we're running out of time.
It's okay, we got time.
Information technology, and here is why. You had somebody on your podcast who suggested a whole new way of running banks. Well-meaning person, all that. Maybe we have a separate broadcast.
We need to do that, actually.
Here's the deal. In 1965, I started working for a bank, one of the biggest banks in the world at the time. I came to realize very shortly after that a bank is all about selling information. That's all it does. So that you have millions of people with $200, $300, $1,000, and they would like to make productive use of the money. So they could go out and study all the financial statements of various companies and give their $200 to the company. That, of course, on the face of it, makes no sense. So what we developed in a society, and just by the way, all societies of whatever ideology did the same thing independently, you came up with an institution which was called a financial intermediary, and it said to these people, give me your $200, don't worry about it, you will get it back, and I'll make the decisions and do all the study and analysis of who I give it to. That is nothing more than saying, we have the information, we do the analysis, we have the experts, and we'll make the loan after we put your $200 together with a million others, and we'll give it to General Motors or IBM or whoever. And that worked beautifully for a long time. And the price the banks charged for doing that, 1965 now, was, let's say, 2 to 2.5%. Now, what happened? All of that information that we had in the banking business, and by the way, if you wanted to get fired in a hurry and maybe even prosecuted, just leave a credit file out. There was a thing in every branch around the world called a book vault. Into the book vault, just like into the cash vault, went your credit files with all the information. That's how valuable it was. What happened very quickly, and by the way, as I say, we would get paid, the banks in general would get paid about 2%. We'd charge the customer 7, we'd pay the depositor 5.
Right?
What happened is, with the information revolution there, the shock was that all this information became readily available sitting down at a terminal. So all the people, all the files, all that became readily available. Nobody needed a bank anymore. So the banks started going out and saying, we've got to survive, survival being a very, pretty strong instinct. And they started doing crazy things, whole different subject for a different time. But their basic business evaporated right out from under them. And I was there to see it happen right in front of my very eyes. The whole society said, in a very short order, we've got all this information now. All I need is a computer terminal and maybe a secretary. And I've got it all. I don't need all your thousands
of
staff.
Was the last book you read that really kind of changed something for you, blew your mind? Because a lot of these books are piggybacking on ideas or adding to ideas you've already known about. But was there a book that I asked you this before, but I mean, probably not recently, right?
Well, you know, I'm going to be 74 this month.
Right.
I'm glad you didn't.
I mean,
the
Black Swan, the Signal and the Noise,
these are all. I think what you do is you begin to build an understanding and a perception of the world you live in. And you kind of lose sight of some of the basic tenets. And then you pick up a book, and I mentioned Zachariah. And you, again, nothing all that new in Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy, not as if I've been blown away by reading something the first time. And you are just reminded and you're more deeply imprinted with something that was there to begin with. But as far as, a big shock, I didn't know that.
What about a mystery? Anything that's still a mystery to you?
Yeah, I mean, the mystery, what I've been delving into an awful lot, not that I'm capable, but I want to know more before I breathe my last, is the whole business of biology and how much more we're learning about that. Mm. So I can't get enough of that. I mean, whether it's animal or... And yesterday, I was reading my grandson's biology book. He's in an advanced biology, and I've been reading a lot of this, but the function and the structure of cells, how DNA determines, and you and I have talked about this in the last couple of days every time we see each other, the nature-nurture thing is still out there. It still fascinates me. I want to learn how the gametes work when, we develop the fetus and all of that stuff. There's been an enormous amount of research.
Yeah, a lot of research.
If you have anyone, besides information technology, if you have any one field where there have been enormous advances, it's probably in the area of biology.
Yeah.
How do enzymes interact with
protein? How do I stay so young looking?
You?
Yeah, that's probably what you're also.
Oh, I wouldn't know that. That's not a mystery to me. No.
Okay. Well, no. I don't know. No. Look at that. We're at an hour, Big Mike. We need you back to talk about banking. Well done, as usual.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate a son of mine.
Yeah.
One of three who.
What? I didn't know you had two others.
Oh,
is that what that other chick?
Could we edit this?
I
didn't
shit.
Want that. You know.
I just found out I have a whole new family.
I have to admit, you're my much-loved son, and I'm very proud of what you've been able to do. When I go to shows and see you, I laugh like hell, and it's hard to believe that that's my own offspring up there.
Well, you know what? You're a big part of my next 1 hour. And by the way, speaking of which, hey, Edmonton, Toronto, this month, I'm coming to you. Hey, Vancouver. Me and Joe Rogan, June 13th, 14th. Actually, I think 12th, 13th, we'll be there tearing it up. I can't wait. It's going to be a great month, May and June. I love what I do. BrianCallen.com, Fighter and the Kids, my other podcast, number two podcast in all of sports. Thank you very much, according to iTunes at least. Then I got the 10-minute podcast. We're going to be doing some live shows. Thank you for listening once again. This is Brian the Kid Callen.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to BrianCallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.